Welcome to Good Evening, the Alfred Hitchcock Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Shea Mutella, and joining me, as always, are my ever-constant train companions, Chris Haig and Tom Caldwell. Tom, you just bumped my foot and you didn't say sorry. What kind of Canadian are you?
Can you hand me my Tim Hortons cup, please?
Tim Hortons cup. Absolutely. Here you go. Here's your Tim Hortons cup. Do you play tennis?
Not very damn well, yeah. Last time I played tennis, I ended up at the chiropractor, so no, it's not a good idea.
Well, maybe our other co-host plays tennis. Chris, do you play tennis?
We played it a lot in the UK. I play tennis pretty well, but not as well as I operate merry-go-rounds.
Man, that shot, like those cops, man, since you brought it up, they just start firing and kill that poor operator. Like, there's got to be, we need to write the tragic story of the merry-go-round operator from this movie. What do you think?
I mean, first of all, I'm in. When watching it, I was like, I want two alternate stories that follow on. I want a story of the guy who crawls underneath, because what is going on? And secondly, I want one with Barbara, because I'm like, what is going on with you, really? Like, let's see what's going on beneath Barbara, as it were. Yes. But yeah, so...
Excellent, right on. Well, we are discussing Strangers on a Train, which many people claim to be Hitchcock's return to form after what lots of fans describe as a run of non-par, under par, below par films over the last few. And we've enjoyed them to some extent, a few of them, but yeah, there's been a few stinkers over the last little bit, so it's nice to get back to classic Hitchcock. And, you know, I think from here on out, we've got Hitchcock in his true form for the remainder of his career. We've got about 15 or 16 movies left, and I think it's Hitchcock all the way through as we know him, as we recognize him when he's on the screen. So, excellent. So, gentlemen, surprise me. Which one of you guys has given us a summary of Strangers on a Train?
Tom? I found one. It's pretty brief, but it works. From IMDb.com. A psychopath forces a tennis star to comply with his theory that two strangers can get away with murder. Dun, dun, dun. So we know one of them's a psychopath.
Yeah, and I want to come back to that theory, because you know what? I think that theory is pretty solid. I think that you just got to make sure you get the right stranger on a train, but we can talk about that later. So, Strangers on a Train is a 1951 American psychological thriller film noir produced and directed by Alfred Hitchcock and based on the 1950 novel by Patricia Highsmith. It was shot in the autumn of 1950 and released by Warner Brothers in June of 1951. And had this been made during COVID, it would have gone straight to HBO Max. It has a running time of 101 minutes, and it's number 32 on AFI's 100 Years, 100 Thrills. Hitchcock secured the rights to Patricia Highsmith's novel for just $7,500 since it was her first novel. As usual, Hitchcock kept his name out of the negotiations to keep the purchase price low. Highsmith was quite annoyed when she later discovered who bought the rights for such a small amount. Strangers on a Train marked something of a renaissance for Hitchcock. After several years of low enthusiasm for his late 40s output, and he threw himself into the micromanagement of some of its production. Hitchcock himself designed Bruno's lobster necktie. Man, that thing was crazy. I'm like, I paused my screen and I'm like, are those lobsters? Like, that is nuts. What do you guys think of that tie?
It is.
I couldn't look beyond the tie clip.
Yeah.
On the clip? Yeah, Bruno, the clip. I thought that was nuts. I'm like, that is the craziest freaking tie I've ever seen. And now I love knowing that Hitchcock designed that tie. Like, I don't know. I was like looking at thing obsessed with, like, what does this have to do with the movie? What do you guys think this lobster tie has to do with the story? Like, because this is like some deep cut that I just couldn't figure out.
They end up getting boiled in hot water or something?
Caught
in a trap?
Lobsters mate for life? I don't know. Some kind of marriage, ironic marriage thing. Like, lobsters mate for life, so... Yeah, he's found his, like, his true, you know, true heart in Anne instead of Miriam, or I don't know. Maybe it just was fun. Maybe he likes, you know, the noise they made with the claws.
The clicking? Well, I think that we should write the film Dial L for Lobster.
Yes.
And see, yeah. Anyways, back to the trivia. Hitchcock himself designed Bruno's lobster necktie revealed in a close-up to have strangling lobster claws. Oh, maybe there you go. So I should just keep reading my notes, I guess, and then I know what we're talking about here. And he purposely selected an orange peel, a chewing gum wrapper, wet leaves, and a bit of crumpled paper that were used for sewer debris in the scene where Bruno inadvertently drops Guy's lighter down the storm drain. One of the most memorable single shots in the Hitchcock canon, it is studied by film classes, says Laura Elliott, who played Miriam, is her character's strangulation by Bruno on the Magic Isle. In one of the most unexpected, most aesthetically justified moments in film, the slow, almost graceful murder is shown as a reflection in the victim's eyeglasses, which have been jarred loose from her head and dropped to the ground. So wonderful. Just a masterpiece shot there. I just love it. The usual angle was a more complex proposition than it seems. The unusual angle was a more complex proposition than it seems. First, Hitchcock got the exterior shots in Canoga Park using both actors. Then later, he and Elliot alone report to a soundstage where there was a large concave reflector on the, set on the floor. The camera was on one side of the reflector, Elliot was on the other, and Hitchcock directed Elliot to turn her back to the reflector and float backwards all the way to the floor, like you were doing the limbo. The first six takes went badly. Elliot thudded to the floor with several feet yet to go, but on the seventh take, she floated smoothly all the way. Hitchcock's ever-strained response, cut, next shot. Hitchcock then had the two elements ingeniously double-printed, yielding a shot of oddly appealing originality with a stark fusion of the grotesque and the beautiful. The aestheticizing of the horror somehow enables the audience to contemplate more fully its reality. Hitchcock was above all the master of great visual set pieces, and perhaps the most memorable sequence in Strangers on a Train is the climactic fight on a berserk carousel. While Guy and Bruno fight, the ride runs out of control until it tears itself to pieces, flinging wooden horses into the crowd and screaming mothers and squealing children. The climactic carousel explosion was a marvel of miniatures and background projection, acting close-ups and other inserts, all of it seamlessly matched and blended under film editor William H. Ziegler's eye. Hitchcock took a toy carousel and photographed it blown up by a small charge of explosives. This piece of film he then enlarged and projected onto a vast screen, positioning actors around and in front of it, so that the effect is one of a mob of bystanders into which plaster horses and passengers are hurled into deadly chaos. It is one of the moments in Hitchcock's work that continues to bring gasps from every audience and applause from cinema students. Now, on to the actors. For Farley Granger, we spoke about him on our episode for Rope, and this is his final Hitchcock appearance. Ruth Roman, who was born Norma Roman on December 22nd of 1922, was an American actress of film, stage, and television. After playing stage roles on the East Coast, Roman relocated to Hollywood to pursue a career in films. She appeared in several uncredited bit parts before she was cast as the leading lady in the Western Harmony Trail from 1944, and in the title role in the serial film Jungle Queen from 1945, her first credited performances. Roman first starred in the title role of Bell Starr's daughter, and she achieved her first notable success with the role in The Widow, and a year later was nominated for the Golden Globe Award for New Star of the Year Actress for her performance in Champion. In the mid-50s, after leaving Warner Brothers, Roman continued to star in films and also began playing guest roles for television series. She also worked abroad and made films in England, Italy, and Spain. She was also a passenger on board the SS Andrea Doria during the famous 1956 sinking. In 1959, she won the Sarah Siddons Award for her work in the play Two for the Seesaw, and her numerous television appearances earned her a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. This is her only Hitchcock film appearance, but she was in the Alfred Hitchcock Hour episode, What Really Happened, and the radio adaptation of Strangers on a Train for Lux Theater, which aired on the 3rd of December, 1951. Now, Robert Hudson Walker was born October 13th, 1918, and he died on August 28th, 1951, so he didn't live too long, and he actually died just a few weeks after this movie came out. He was an American actor, best remembered for his starring role as the villain in Strangers on a Train. And he started in youthful boy next door roles, often as a World War II soldier. One of these roles was opposite his first wife, Jennifer Jones, in the World War II epic, Since You Went Away. And he also played Jerome Kern in Till the Clouds Roll By. Twice divorced by 30, he suffered from alcoholism and mental illness, which were exacerbated by his painful separation and divorce from Jones. This is his only Hitchcock appearance. Now, one other thing that I found very interesting about Robert Walker was that Star Trek fans who listen to this show may actually recognize his son from the original Star Trek series. Robert Hudson Walker Jr. played Charlie in the first season episode of the original Star Trek called Charlie X. So, and once I knew that it was his son, I'm like, holy smokes, that is totally, totally his son. Looks just like him. Leo Grattan Carroll was an English actor, and he was best known for his roles in six Hitchcock films, including Spellbound, Strangers on a Train, and North by Northwest, and in three television series, Topper, Going My Way, and The Man from U.N.C.L.E. He is name-checked in the song Science Fiction Double Feature from the Rocky Horror Show with the line, I knew Leo G. Carroll was over a barrel. So we will see him one more time in North by Northwest. But again, we have seen him in Rebecca, Suspicion, Spellbound, The Parroting Case, and Strangers on a Train. Now, finally, Hitchcock's cameo appearance is in this movie at about 11 minutes into the film. He's seen carrying a double bass as he climbs onto the train. So I think that's pretty cool that we've got the double bass again. I mean, I think I read somewhere that he has four cameos where he's carrying some sort of instrument. And I'm going to continue on with my theory that this is the same character popping in from movie to movie. So I'll just continue believing that for the rest of my life.
So. And the double bass has got to be the most awkward instrument to travel with ever.
Yes. Well, when I was reading the book by Donald Spotto, he was talking about all the doubles in this, right? And, you know, the tennis part of the movie was written by Hitchcock. Like, that's not a part of the book. And, you know, tennis is doubles. You play doubles in tennis and whatnot. And then we've got, like, these double murders that are supposed to happen. You know, we got these double scotches that are ordered at the beginning. We got the double bass. We get a lot of double shots between the characters. You know, so, like, throughout the whole movie, the doubles is a thing that Hitchcock keeps bringing back as a theme, and there's just too many to mention. Tom, let's go to you first. Have you seen this movie before? What are your initial impressions?
I have seen this a number of times. I believe this is one of the films that was covered two or three years ago at the Regina Library with the Hitchcock series that Gord Pepper instructed, because I'm very familiar with a lot of it from that time. And again, I, you know, prepping for our show, I did watch the entire thing yesterday, and it's a great movie. Like, it's very fun. There's a lot going on. You really have to pay attention. And it really is a classic for out of all the Hitchcock films, this is probably, like, for me, like a top 10 critical film of his to watch if you're gonna watch any of the films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Chris, you've seen this many times.
I haven't.
Whoa.
It's the first time I've watched it.
Whoa.
Pretty much, yeah. It's weird. It's not really on a lot in the UK when Hitchcock's, it's usually stuff that's a bit more family friendly, like your Vertigo isn't family friendly, but it's on a lot, but like Rear Window and all that sort of thing. But no, I hadn't watched it until this past week, and I enjoyed it. There are certain things I won't say issue with, but there are certain things where I'm like, oh, okay, I can critique this, and I think this could be better, that sort of thing. But it's such an interesting premise, and concept that gets really spun out into this kind of really interesting taut film. And it wouldn't have been the same if anyone else had done it. And, you know, it fits so neatly into that canon of Hitchcock's Wrong Man Accused murders. You know, Wrong Man Accused kind of archetype he has. Mm-hmm. But no, I really enjoy this. I think it's gorgeously shot. I think, by and large, it's well acted. I have one controversial take on the acting, which we will probably get to at some stage. But yeah, I think in terms of shot, I think in terms of the tension, the entire funfair scene, like the Tunnel of Love scene, and the, you know, that shot that we talked about where Miriam is being murdered through her own eyeglasses, I think is just absolutely gorgeous. And then it's interesting that it really, like you said, it really is a study in doubles and the way that we reflect each other. And it's almost like a sort of doppelganger story. Because even there's a certain point where Bruno, he's demonstrating how he would kill someone. And he demonstrates on a woman at a party he's at. And he's doing it all in jest and all that sort of thing. And then he gets transfixed by Barbara, who herself is the double of Anne. Which I don't think he's ever brought up before. Like, he's never gone, do you know, your sister's the double image of my of my cheating wife. And it's that kind of profound effect. Because, you know, and it's all about balance them off against each other. And yeah, tennis doubles and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I know, I really enjoyed this. There were certain moments when I enjoyed it a bit less, but then I think as it is, everything started to come together towards the end, and the, I won't say ridiculous because it's quite fun, but let's say the spectacle of the carousel at full tilt, I enjoyed and thought it was quite good.
Yeah. So this is the second time that I've seen this movie, but it's been a very long time since I've seen it. And I will confess that my initial introduction to this movie was actually through Throw Mama from the Train. Have you seen that?
Yeah, for sure.
I've heard of it.
Yeah, Billy Crystal and Danny DeVito star in it. And it's basically just a comedic ripoff of this movie. And Danny DeVito gets the idea to murder his mom from watching Strangers on a Train in a theater. Right, and the whole crisscross scene, and so Billy Crystal's, it has to do with his wife and whatnot. I don't remember all the details of the movie, but it's basically just a comedic version of this movie, and I really enjoyed it as a kid. We saw it as a kid. I haven't seen that one in even longer than it's been since I've seen this one here. But as best as I can remember, I actually enjoyed this movie more this time than I did the first time. I think the first time I saw it, I thought it was pretty slow, but this time I was very captivated. I was completely into this. I think the acting is fantastic in this and very, very interesting. Very interesting choices on the characters and the character development, which we'll get into. But yeah, this is definitely, I think, one of Hitchcock's best films. And I think if I went back to my Letterboxd right now for where I put it, I think I put this in my top five for his films right now, because I really, really, really enjoyed this one here. So let's discuss. So let's talk about this idea. Like, I think this is a very, very fascinating idea for a movie. Like, this idea of the strangers meeting and coming up with a plan to murder somebody from each other's life. Like, what a fascinating concept. Like, this could almost be something that people could get away with, right? Because if you know, you'd have to plan it and whatnot beyond this. But when are you going to just sit down and talk to somebody and come up with the idea to murder, you know, to murder somebody that you want to get rid of or something like that? But I think it's very interesting. And, you know, we got this very interesting character of, oh my goodness, I'm so bad with names. What's Robert?
Bruno?
Bruno. Goodness, jeez, we're talking about his tie there. I'm so bad with names, guys. I'm so terrible. But Bruno's this very interesting character. He wants to kill his dad. And I don't know about the book. I don't know about it at all. But there's discussion and talk about how, you know, this is a film with homosexual undertones. And, you know, watching the movie this time, I definitely get the impression that Bruno's a gay character. And which, watching it, makes it really interesting, because his parents, I think, are so fascinating in this movie, and it's like really captivating to watch them, because like, so his dad's like mad at him and he wants to kill his dad, so the impression that we get out of that is that clearly his dad is upset that he's gay. Like, that's my interpretation of it, and so his dad treats him poorly and whatnot. But to me, the interesting thing is that the impression that I get from his mom is she's like completely oblivious to it, or she's in like some state of denial. And I think his mom is actually a really fascinating character. You know, like that scene where she's giving him a manicure is like kind of creepy. Like, it's really weird, you know, and his mom's got this really weird portrayal. So I kind of wanted to start the discussion with that, and ask you guys what you thought about Bruno as a character and his interaction with his family. Chris, let's start with you.
So Bruno is, it's weird in the, he's the villain, but he is my favorite character in this.
Oh, yeah.
I think he's so fascinating. And I think, because the issue when I was like, oh, I have a controversial take, is that there are parts of this film where I don't like Farley Granger's acting as Guy. There are certain moments when he says stuff and it's so wooden, and I'm like, oh, okay. But then with, I've forgotten the actor's name completely, the guy who plays Bruno, it's
Robert Walker.
Robert Walker. Thank you very much.
We're all bad at names on the show.
I remember actors and forget names.
I opened the web. I have a web page open with the names on it, so I'm cheating.
I've got the Wikipedia open and I scrolled up, going, "Oh God, where is it?" Robert Walker for me is one of the best Hitchcock performances, because it's a villain who is so entrancing. Every scene he's in, he completely commands it, you know, from when they first meet on the train and they have that discussion of like, oh well, here's how you would get away with the perfect murder, or you know, every creepy, brilliant little scene. And yeah, I completely agree with the dynamic between him and his parents. Yeah, it gives the complete energy of someone who is, if not closeted, but the parents are somehow aware. So like, yeah, the dad is consciously or not aware that the son isn't exactly straight. And I won't say it's a problem with Hitchcock's things, because it's very much of the time where kind of homosexuality and anything that isn't straight gets kind of coded into villainy. But it is really interesting, because Bruno is not only gay, he is in love with Guy. You know, he has this complete obsession with him where it's like, oh yeah, I'll kill your wife and that sort of thing. And in my head, I was like, oh, he goes up to Guy because he's famous and he's attractive and all that sort of thing. And he's a bit in love with him. So even though he knows that Guy isn't into, well, guys, it's kind of fulfilling some weird love or some, you know, and the fact he can get his overbearing dad out of the way as well, I think really fits that. It's a really interesting dynamic.
Is it possible that Bruno deliberately sat across from Guy and pretended to run into him?
Yeah, very possible. Yeah.
I mean, like I said, I've not read the book. I've only read one Patricia Highsmith, which is great. I've just not had a chance to read this yet. But yeah, I would absolutely believe the fact that he knew exactly who Guy was and kind of engineered this whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with cinema of this era, you know, going back to Rope, and like I said, when I was younger and watching Rope, like I never caught, you know, the homosexual undertones that were there. And the first time that I saw this, I probably didn't catch it either, right? Because, like, you know, when I'm a kid, a teenager and whatnot, I'm just watching it for the murder, right? So that's what I'm watching it for. But now that I'm older, I'm a little bit more wise to the world and, you know, certain aspects that I wouldn't have been exposed to as a youth. I wonder if this is an element that's in the novel, or if this is something that Hitchcock has brought to the story. Like, same with Rope. I wonder if that was an element of the play, or if that was something Hitchcock brought to the play. Because if, like, Hitchcock brought the tennis to this film, right? So this was not something that was in the book. So I don't know if this character was gay in the book. It's not really, I guess it's not that important, but I guess the thing that I want to bring up is if it is or if it's not, I think it's interesting that Hitchcock is kind of breaking ground with this, because this isn't a time when you really associate gay characters on screen very often. Like, our friend Manish that we've had on the show several times has another podcast called Queer Now, and, you know, discussing queer cinema and whatnot. And so I guess he'd probably be a better person to be able to answer this question as to, like, how many movies in this era you know, may have had, like, this queer coding or whatnot in their films. But it, to me, it seems like something that's not very common for this time. And so here we are, we've got a second Hitchcock in relatively short order, right? It's not been that long since Rope. It's only been a few years since Rope. So, I don't know, Hitchcock seems to be breaking ground to me. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting as well, just off the back of that, is because it comes from Patricia Highsmith. So in the book, from what I'm aware, it's just a subtext and all that sort of thing, but Highsmith herself famously wrote The Price of Salt, which was, you know, people may know as Carol, which is the first kind of mainstream lesbian novel to have a happy ending. Because previously, you know, you'd get pulp fiction during, like, the 40s and 50s and into the 60s where, you know, there'd be, you know, gay stories or lesbian stories or queer stories, but they always ended with either the characters reforming and realizing it was all like an evil plot or something, or they die. Mm. And so it's interesting that this is the same writer who gave us a properly happy ending, and I read it just before Christmas, and it does have a really happy ending. And then on Stranger Train, there is still that queer context, and you're absolutely right. Manish will know far more than, you know, me or you about this kind of thing, but it would be interesting to kind of look at what the kind of Hays Code allowed in terms of coding homosexuality during that time, because the Hays Code wasn't repealed until the 60s, so you could never have had an openly gay character, hero or villain, but you can still code them as villainous and gay in a different sense, as long as they were punished by the end of the film.
Yeah. So that book you read, sorry, just one quick question, is that the same author, that book that you read?
Yeah, so The Price of Salt was the original title for Carol, and that was written by Patricia Highsmith, who wrote Strangers on the Train.
Okay, so I don't know if Patricia Highsmith was gay, but maybe if she wrote another book with gay characters, then that probably would be, yeah, that Bruno would have been gay in the book as well. Yeah.
I mean, from and this is literally from Wikipedia, but it says, Hitchcock got a treatment that pleased him on the second attempt from writer Whitfield Cook, who wove a homoerotic subtext, only hinted at in the novel, into the story and softened Bruno from a coarse alcoholic into a dapper, charming mama's boy, cool, a much more Hitchcockian villain. Cool. So I think, and that's from McGilligan 2004, so I think that is the case that it is there in subtext, and it's almost like they've gone the other... the other way compared to, like, say, you know, Dashiell Hammett and the Maltese Falcon, where they had something that was far more explicit in the book and have softened it for the film. They've gone the other way with this. It's only hinted at or sort of vaguely implied in the book. And during the treatment, they've gone, no, okay, we're really going to lean into this kind of queer aspect. Mm-hmm. Cool. And make the villain more villainous, which, again, I think they got away with because the fact that it's not the hero, he's not a kind of quote-unquote sympathetic character. He ends up, you know, obviously dying and being the villain.
Sorry for interrupting you, Tom. You were going to say...
No, my new favorite resource book, The Camera Lies by Dan Callahan, there's a quick quote here where Peter Bogdanovich had asked Hitchcock, is Bruno gay? Hitchcock replies, I would think so. It wasn't specified, but he could have been. Oh, yes. So Hitchcock is somewhat agreeing, but not explicitly saying. But maybe it was one of those things where he was just trying to not overly admit it in the interview, like not promote it too much in the interview, even though he knew very well that it was true in the film.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. You see, there's some directors who, like, purposely do things, and some directors who, like, purposely don't do things. Like, it's funny when they do something just for the sake of doing it. Like, I just watched a bonus feature, this is a little tangent, for Jason Goes to Hell, The Final Friday, and in the there's a scene where, when Jason's inhabiting this one guy, he straps another guy down and, like, shaves his mustache off. And he's like, for 20 years, people have been asking him, what does this scene mean? And he's like, it doesn't mean anything aside from the fact that I knew people would be asking me about it for the rest of my life. I just wanted to do something that people would be like, what does that mean? So, I don't know. But, I think it's probably somewhere in there where maybe Hitchcock didn't want to admit it for the interview, but it's probably closer to the fact that that's what he wanted in the script, because Hitchcock's the kind of guy where there's nothing that he does that's not intentional.
Right.
You know, he's that kind of director. So he would know what he wanted that character to be. He wouldn't be like, "Well, I don't know, maybe." Right? He's not that kind of director, right? He's like, "This is what I want. I want it on the screen. Do it for me or not." You know, or like, "Do it for me, you're not going to be part of the production," or whatever it is, right? So I don't know. That's just the Hitchcock that I know.
Well, I mean, literally just further down in the same quote, he has a quote about intense interest in character delineation, and that's like food. So you'd think when he's being so specific as to what a character eats, he you know, it's almost that kind of Kubrickian thing of like, oh no, everything is there for a reason, right, for a specific thing. So he wouldn't have just gone, maybe he's gay, maybe he's not, right, who knows?
Exactly, yeah.
It's like Bruno is gay, and that's fine. But he probably, because whenever he had the Bogdanovich interviews, he probably couldn't have come out and said, "Oh yeah, I always intended for so-and-so to be gay." Because if he was still making films at the time, there might have been some, you know, in the weird way that making movies happens, there could have been some blowback on people saying, "Oh well, I don't want any gay characters in my films." It's just like, well, he still died at the end, so calm down.
Yes, so, it is like, one of those things.
Yeah. It's not a sympathetic story about Bruno.
We've talked a lot in previous episodes about Hitchcock enjoys the love triangle. So I'm not the biggest geometry expert, but is this like a love hexagon or something? Because it's
kind of
Guy.
Yeah.
There's Guy and Bruno are the main male characters. So Bruno wants Guy to kill Bruno's dad, but Bruno wants potentially to hook up with Guy, but Guy, his current wife, he wants to potentially kill so that he can be with his new girl, Anne. So it gets very complicated. But what I loved about Bruno, his character in the first bit of the film, where he comes up to Guy on the train and says, "Hey, I'm going to kill your wife for you. How do you like them apples?" He basically goes ahead and kills the wife, and then comes up to Guy and says, "Okay, I killed your wife. Now you got to kill my dad." But Guy the whole time is like, no, I didn't agree to this." So like he gets railroaded. He gets pushed into this. So Bruno is so aggressive that there is no real agreement. There's no contract, but he basically is blackmailing or.
No, see, that's the thing. Like, that's this character's like messed up, right? Like he's psychotic, and yeah. On the train, as Guy is leaving the room, Bruno's asking him, he's like, "So we're gonna do this, right?" And Guy's like, sure, like whatever, not expecting him to actually do it. But by him saying sure, Bruno is accepting that's acknowledgement that they're gonna proceed with this plan.
And
you know,
Bruno realizes that he still has the lighter that belongs to the Guy when Guy leaves the train car. And he kind of goes, "Hey, Guy, oh, no, wait a minute. Maybe I'll keep the lighter." Mm-hmm. So the lighter becomes a vital piece of the plot. Like, it's a piece of evidence, like the property of the cigarette lighter that belongs to Guy that has his name on it. And so Bruno right away is going ahead with this. Like, he would have done this even without talking to Guy. Like, he's just
I think
matter what. He's just looking for someone to kill.
Yeah.
It's the same energy as saying, we'll go out for a drink. Oh no, we'll go to the cinema, and then a week later they text you saying, "I bought the tickets," and you're like, "Oh no, I never actually I just said vaguely, yeah, we'll go," and someone's already like, "But I've bought everything."
I'm picking you up at 7. Like what?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. It's like someone knocking your door saying, like, "Great, I've come around for dinner," and when he said come around every time, you're like, "Oh, I didn't mean it like this.
I didn't mean you can come over any time."
Yeah. I was being nice.
Yeah.
I didn't
No, I'm not being nice. Get away.
But it's the it's the Bruno coming up and saying, "Hey, let's kill each other's victims." But it's the preposterousness or the insanity of that statement that Guy's just like, "Oh yeah, no, we're not going to do that." Like, he sloughs it off because he's like, "You're being ridiculous. That's not really going to happen." But Bruno's like, "No, hey, dude, we're going to have a contract killing agreement. It's like a contra deal. It's not murder for hire. It's murder for trade. Like, they're bartering, right?"
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a verbal agreement, which one of them just kind of goes, oh, yeah. I just walked off thinking, like, great, I've just spent, like, an hour on a train with someone who isn't all there, doesn't think about it, and then Miriam turns up dead. So, which, can I just say, I was fully ready to be like, oh, I'm going to feel bad about her dying. Because they were like, oh, you know, she's pregnant and she's, you know, his wife and everything. And then in that one scene, she's so unlikable. Yeah. I was like, I'll kill her for you.
The scene in the music store?
No, in the music store and at the amusement park where she's just like, I want food. And then she's like, she sees Bruno and is like just instantly totally captivated with him to the point where she's like sloughing off these two dudes that she's with.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So this is a she's portrayed as a very unlikable character, like right from the get-go.
Yeah.
Which is very interesting. And I don't think it's discussed enough that this woman is pregnant when she gets killed.
Yep.
You know, I think that's like, whoa, like Bruno wouldn't have known that, right? But I think that's a very interesting choice for Hitchcock to go ahead with that, you know.
Mm, yeah. It's weird because normally you would... A character being pregnant in a film is usually translates to innocence, to being sweet, to nice, to being someone likable. You know, in any action movie, if there's a pregnant woman, you're like, oh, they're going to protect her, they're going to look after her, what sort of thing. Whereas with this, not only is she not innocent and not likable, she's a total monster. There's no... You know, there's no attempt to make her likable, which I think is a deliberate part in the sense you don't really feel bad when she dies. Because if you had a real... I don't think they would have done it. If you had a really sympathetic character get killed and she's pregnant, I think the censors wouldn't have allowed for it. And then it would have been a completely different film, and it would have taken away from some like the dark comedy and the dark joy of the film.
Could it possibly be one of those? She's saying she's pregnant, but she's not.
Sure, absolutely. Could be that kind
of, because she's a bit of a she's a player. She's a bit of a hussy, right? She's got multiple men in her life, and she's kind of bouncing around a lot. She's a woman of bad reputation, and so perhaps she was making up the pregnancy thing as a ploy.
Yeah.
But
the thing with that, though, is that in the movie, there's no reason, I guess there's no real reason to doubt that, right? Because he, you know, when he thought they were getting a divorce, he knew she was pregnant. So it wasn't like something that she pulled out, right? And he knows that it's not his baby. Like, she didn't try and tell him it was his, right? She both of them knew that it was some other guy's, like whoever she was with. Was it with one of the two people that she went to the fair with? I don't know. But
I'm pretty sure with this episode, when we release this on our podcast, we're going to have to include like a Venn diagram and some flow charts of how this connects to that, connects to this, connects to that. Yeah. And if this happens, then that happens. And yeah, it's quite complicated.
Yeah.
In a good
way. I mean, if nothing else, it proves that pregnant people can be bad too. Like, you can be a horrible pregnant person. And that's... it's a nice little shattering of stereotypes.
Right.
You know, pregnant people can do stuff too. Becoming pregnant doesn't make you a nice person. Plenty of pregnant people are monsters.
Yes.
And there's nothing wrong with
pregnant
that.
People.
Pregnant people are monsters. Not all pregnant people. I just realized I said that. I was like, pregnant people are monsters. I'm like,
no, there's our title for the show. Anyway,
pregnant people are monsters. But yeah, it's kind of that whole, oh, she's not necessarily a fallen woman, but that kind of, oh, she's pregnant with another man's child, and it's completely there's no reason for her to be pregnant apart from just an extra way that she's like, haha, I'm not actually going to divorce you, I'm going to keep running around and tell people it's your child.
Right.
She's just like, she's horrible, 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 and then you're just like, okay, great, kill her then.
Yeah.
Cool.
It's more fire for the, or more, what is it, more fuel for the fire.
For the fire, yeah.
More fuel for the fire, so. Okay, so I will say, Chris, for something you said earlier, I don't read that Bruno's in love with Guy. So maybe I'm just naive. But I know that I've heard other people say that before. But for me watching it, I don't get that read off of the Bruno character.
And that's totally fair.
Yeah, I don't know. Tom, what did you... It sounds like you got that read, though, as well.
I I was sort of oblivious to all of that when I was watching the movie. Mm-hmm. I did look at Bruno hanging around his rich parents' house is wearing this one bathrobe, and we're like, damn, that's a cool-looking bathrobe. I never really got into the whole gay subtext thing of it when I was watching it. But now, like, that was yesterday when I watched the movie. And the day today, now that we're taping the show and I'm reading some books and listening to the commentary that the two of you are going through, like, it fits very easily. Like, it does make sense.
Yeah. Like Chris, you'll help me if I'm, like, using wrong terms, right? But, I mean, like, the thing that they do in films of this era, especially when they show gay characters, is they're basically, like, effeminate, right? And so here he is, he's getting his hands done, and he's wearing this silk nightgown and whatnot. Like, and he's very fancily dressed and whatnot, and he takes care of his appearance and whatnot. And so, like, that's their coded signal, I think, to show that this is a gay character.
Yeah, exactly. It's this sort of fey, feminine stereotype that goes against, and it's again, using go back to your idea of doubles, it's against Bruno, who is an athlete and is very much a man's man, and is like, you know, he's pursuing, you know, he wants to marry his true love, Anne, and it's kind of this heterosexual ideal and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he's coded in a certain way that a lot of people were, and sometimes it really fits and sometimes it doesn't. So, you know, the one I always think of, there's a 1944 film called Laura, which, if you've not seen it, is one of the best film noirs of all time. And there's a character in there called Waldo Leidecker, who is coded the exact same way, very fey, very feminine, but because of the code at the time, they had to basically insist that he was straight, and it's so weird. It's so weird. It's like, I mean, this is a modern reference, but if you've ever seen a High School Musical film, there's a character called Ryan in it who is the gayest character, but because it's on Disney, they have to insist that he's actually straight. And it's fine if you're into that stuff and you're straight. That's not the issue. It's the fact that when a character is so coded as gay that you don't see it, or that they then insist that, oh, it's not a thing, or it's this, or it's whatever. But it's through that. It's through a particular lens, and you've got to view everything in its historical context anyway. So, yeah.
Some of the lore of this film talks about the legend of the scene where the carousel is running amok. The carousel breaks down, right? And everyone's going to get injured and hurt because the carousel is spinning, and they have to figure out a way to stop it. And the motor control for the carousel is in the hub in the center, and there's a man, like a carnival worker, that's a guy that says, I'll climb under the spinning carousel and I'll rescue everybody by shutting down the motor. Now, I had heard some legend in Hitchcock lore that this was not shot safely, that it was just a man that worked on the film that's like, no, I'll just go do this. But I don't believe that. I think that's a bit of hype. Like, it was way too dangerous a scene. And the way it's photographed and the storyboarding is way too carefully done that there's a camera underneath. But it's very, very dramatic. The thought that this guy was climbing in what is really like a 2-foot-high space between the grass and the spinning carousel, which could easily have caught him and killed him. And that's a very, very dramatic, suspenseful moment. And that character does very well portraying, to the point that he stops halfway, takes his kerchief and wipes the sweat off his brow, you know? And then he finally gets in there and he gets hold of the motor control, the throttle or whatever, and he shuts down the carousel. Yeah. And that was really well. Like, that's some very modern, dynamic, suspenseful action that's happening right there.
Do you want to know the best bit about that scene? So the guy who's doing it, he volunteered to do it because he's not an actor or a stunt performer. He's a genuine carousel operator. So that means when they were setting this up, they were like, well, we're just going to have to, you know, do all that sort of thing. It means he kind of went, I'll do it. You want to crawl underneath? And like, he's like, it's fine. I've done it before. And, you know, if he'd raised his head an inch and everything, just would have turned his head into
my
jam.
Point was that I wonder if that legend that you're talking about was true, or if that is part of Hitchcock's marketing ability, maybe. Like his tendency to make up stories that, you know, generate publicity and people, oh, that was an amazing bit about that film, right? But he could very well have been like a real carnival worker that they hired and they agreed to let him be the actor in the film. You know what I mean? But that's a good example of Hitchcock as the master marketing guy, you know, creating these legends and these stories that go on their own legs to promote the film, right?
Well, yeah, and he does it later on, so we see it with Psycho, and there's other films where it's like, oh no, here's how you build up the mythos and the hype and kind of the brand. And you see it with some directors now, kind of like your Nolans, your Andersons, your, you know, the ones who have a specific sort of vision and a like a trademark or a certain style or whatever. Yeah, I totally agree. You certainly see it. And Hitchcock's thing was like, okay, I'm going to build intrigue and mystery and suspense, and then also, yeah, include some of the darker stuff, which is like, oh yeah, that could have killed that guy.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a
it all goes back to his biography when we talked about his story as a child of misbehaving, and his dad gets him locked in a police jail cell for 5 or 10 minutes. Like that whole thing, he's told that story 100 times on every interview he's ever done, and to me that really comes across like a bit of marketing hype where he just made this story up, and because it makes a good story, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and there's nothing wrong with that. Like that's good. Like I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying that I think he had that talent for making up those stories that add to his character. They add to his personality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So I want to talk about Pat Hitchcock because I think she's freaking fantastic in this movie. You know, the scene when they're at the dinner party and Bruno is choking that old woman and he just looks at her, and the aftermath of that scene as well, like you can just see the terror in her eyes and in her face, and I think she gives a really, really marvelous performance in this movie, and is definitely probably the other highlight of the film after Robert Walker. What do you think?
I agree. Oh, she totally, she does very well. She's very unique character, and her was it Shadow of a Doubt, where the men at the dinner table are constantly being private detectives and they're talking about how to murder and how to solve crimes.
Yep.
But she's that, she's the modern, in modern day, she'd be the person that's always watching the detective shows and explaining how murders happen.
Yeah.
And reading the murder article in the newspaper and explaining and saying, this guy killed that girl or whatever, this is how that happened. But she is blunt and being, as they say in one of the books I was reading today, she's being American. She is not a polite British woman. She is a blunt, rude American, just telling everything as it is. And she's a busybody. She's getting in between, and she's calling it everything as she sees it. And it's fun. It really is a fun character to watch, right?
I was totally thinking of those guys from Shadow of a Doubt as well when she was on there. I'm like, yeah, this is just right with those guys there.
Yeah. As much as I do love Bruno, and... But she's kind of my favorite character in this, and I think she's great. Like she didn't act a lot, and she did 3 appearances in her dad's films, and she didn't act a lot, but you know, many films overall. But I think she's absolutely great, and she gets a lot more to do than she did last time, because last time it was she played Chubby in Stage Fright, which was a tiny role, and compared to this, it's like the secondary female role, really, because Miriam's only in the film for the first 25 minutes, and then she's...
And Psycho was her other role, right?
Yeah, I'll be honest, I'm going to say it's been a while since I've really seen Psycho, but I mean, yeah, I think
she's secretary
in the opening scene. Yeah,
she's the other secretary that... has the story about... what was it? Her mother-in-law gave her a Valium on her wedding night and all this horrible stuff. But she just, she's that same really chatty, bossy, kind of rude character. Mm. But she adds a lot. She adds a lot to the scenes that she's in. She does very well.
She's in 10 Alfred Hitchcock Presents episodes, though, as well, hey?
Oh, good.
Yeah, she's...
Oh, yes.
She's been in quite a few of them. And I just recently watched one called Silent Witness, where she has a pretty major role in that episode.
Great.
That's fab.
No, she does well.
Can I talk a little bit about some... Because I really love the way this is shot.
No, we're not going to talk about that.
Okay, never mind.
Just kidding. Go ahead.
There are a few... I think... And it's weird in that, obviously, Hitchcock shoots stuff really well. But for me, it's so beautifully composed, is this film. And there's two shots that really stand out in my mind. And it's this beautiful visual kind of... And it's not like oh, God, what do you call it when it's like a split, like a diopter split lens or something, yeah. You know, where you can able to focus on something in the foreground and some background. I don't think it's quite that, but the scene in the music shop where Miriam and Guy are having that kind of angry conversation in like a private booth, and then there's a layer of people behind them, and then a further layer of people behind them, and it's just this idea of like layers and people listening in and this kind of depth to the scene and to what the camera shows, I think is absolutely gorgeous. And then it gets replicated at the end where, you know, the police have arrived at the fun fair and Guy's arrived and they're talking, and it appears again and again. It's just so beautifully shot and composed, you know, and you get all this great intercut as well. So during like the tennis scenes, you see, you know, there's Guy and his opponent are doing the shots and everything, and it's all these really fast cuts and, you know, really enjoyable stuff. And then, you know, where Bruno loses the lighter, all these agonizing shots as he sort of inches his way to get it out of the drain. And I really enjoy how this film is composed and put together and edited.
One of the tennis matches, there's a great shot of the crowd watching. And it's that whole left, right. The entire crowd is going left, right. And isn't it Bruno sitting in the middle of the crowd staring right at the camera?
What a great shot. I'm glad you brought that up, Tom.
There's an old thing in police science where the documentary I watched anyway talks about, like, if you're the Secret Service and there's 200 people in a room because the president is about to walk in, the person you watch in the crowd is the person that's not clapping and not cheering. The person that's doing something different from everybody else in the room is the problem maker. And when Bruno is the only guy in that whole crowd not watching the tennis match, it's like, whoa!
Such a wonderful
It's very
shot,
powerful,
yeah.
right? Yeah, he's the problem.
Love it. Yes, he is.
And in the Tunnel of Love, the boats go into the Tunnel of Love. There's lots of there's things that happen in there, but we never go in with them. The camera never goes in with them. We just see them as they come out again. We hear what's going on, but we don't get to go into that private space.
No, but we do get those gorgeous sort of shadow shots where it really teases the idea that Bruno is kind of sneaking up behind, because it just, yeah, we don't go in, but we sort of see the shadows on the wall. And, yeah, all we can hear is Miriam and her paramours.
Giggling
and that kind of stuff. And then it sort of just cuts and you think, oh, God, they're going to be dead or something going on. And then they emerge and it's a big kind of brief, like, oh, okay, that's not the thing. But, yeah, and then you mentioned it in, like, the first 5 minutes, but it's that famous shot of Miriam's glasses as she's killed.
Wonderful, wonderful shot. So amazing.
Oh, God, it's good.
And remember, I tweeted out, I'm like, chef's kiss. I just tweeted out that image, and I'm like, chef's kiss.
Yes.
And remember, and again, we go back to this a lot. This is real filmmaking. There's no digital nothing. There's no special effects. There's no computer-based editing going on here. This is practical effects happening.
Right on. Well, we're approaching an hour here, guys. Is there anything else that we haven't touched on yet that you'd like to address?
I'm good.
I mean, there. Chris,
I can't think of it. We've really, and I think we've given this film a really fair shake and given it the love it deserves, because it is. It's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it's really good.
It's one that I will be personally revisiting, because I have a feeling I'll enjoy it even more the second time around.
Yeah.
So
excellent. Tom, what kind of rating would you give this film?
I will give it 5 out of 5. Corn dogs, bags of popcorn, and sodas.
Chris,
I will give it 4.5 vinyls at the music store when everyone can clearly hear you having an argument.
4.5? Why do you hate this movie?
I'm giving it the half because I want to grow into loving it even more. Because I've genuinely only seen it one time, and I'm like, I don't want to be like it's a 5-star in case it depreciates.
Chris is starting.
But I'm really like
Chris is engaging in a relationship with this film. I mean, that's fair.
To be honest, in the case of like when we do these things, the more I talk about it, I'm like, oh god, I did like that, and oh god, that's great as well. Because I'd completely forgotten about Pat Hitchcock. I talked about Barbara. I was like, my god, it's such a good performance. Mm-hmm. Well done.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm giving it 4.5. It may become a 5 if we ever do like a retrospective ranking thing. Yeah. But yeah,
excellent. Well, I'm going to give this 5 out of 5 Coke bottle glasses for sure. So. Awesome, excellent. Tom, where can people find you when you're not playing tennis?
At the chiropractor. my concentration lately has been over at our Facebook page. A little quick plug that if anybody hasn't listened to our episode 50 yet, get back on over there and check out the review we did of the Camera Lies book. And we've had a lot of awesome episodes since episode 40. Until where we are right now, if I don't say so myself, I think we've been doing some good work and some amazing films we've had the luxury of talking about.
Mm-hmm. Got some good feng shui going on. It's almost like we know what we're doing now.
Yeah, we've done this before, right?
Yeah, we've done it once or twice. Chris, where can people find you when you're not planning how ways to murder your father?
Ironically, my dad listens to these, so I promise. I promise. I'm not.
We're kidding, Dad.
I'm not. I know, bless him, he's genuinely sweet. He's like, where can I listen to your show? And I'm like, okay, I'll send you links. I promise.
Hi,
I'm
Chris's dad. Dad.
Hi, Chris's dad.
How you doing? We love Chris. He's a great guy.
Oh, God. I'm gonna have to deliberately say it right. You're going to have to listen all the way to the end of this one. Why? Because you get a shout out, Dad. When I'm not apparently planning to not murder my father, you can find me on Twitter at @higher_boy. Come and say hi. My Twitter has become a lot more relaxed in the light of certain changes in politics that have been happening. There's a lot less kind of panic retweeting going on. So yeah, I'm a bit more happier. So yeah, feel free to say hi there. That's about it.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And when I'm not trying to ruin my wife's life by taking her money and forcing her to raise the baby that I'm pregnant with from somebody else, I don't know, that didn't quite work. But
I was like, is this just a confession? Is this? You're like, I'm just going to ruin my wife's life, and I'm just like, oh. Okay.
This episode will end up being evidence in court.
Yeah, Exhibit A.
Exhibit A. Good evening, the podcast on Strangers on a Train. You can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. You can find me with 3 other podcasts. I'm over on the Nerd Party Network with a show that we've rebranded now. It's called House Lights, where we cover film directors just like we do here. We've finished David Fincher, and we are now into our Christopher Nolan series of films. And then over on the United Federation of Podcasts, I've got 2 shows. One's called Infinite Diversity, which is all about new Star Trek, and one called Franchise Fatigue, where we look at movies, remakes, and sequels. Thank you so much to the Fandom Podcast Network for hosting our show. You can find our show in their feed as well as our own independent feed. Please leave us a rating and review on iTunes. We haven't had one in a while, but it definitely helps the show get found by people. You couldn't help us out more than by retweeting our tweets, sharing our Facebook pages, and giving us a rating and review on iTunes. We would love that, guys. Take a listen to Annie and Catherine and their show Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Presents podcast. With their show and our show combined, you get a near comprehensive look at the Grandmaster's work. And Jason Cullimore, our good friend, thank you so much for our wonderful theme music. So until next time, when we cover I Confess, good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.